May 2016, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are my colleagues Ernest Perry and Deborah Mason. On our program this week, journalists at the University of Kansas sue administrators claiming they lost funding over a critical editorial. Two feminist icons have something to say about who women should support in the presidential race, and what would lead editors at The Bustle to ask new employees about their sexual orientation, political affiliation, or if they've ever been sexually assaulted. There's a lot more that hopefully we'll get to, but first, let's start by talking about the spread of the Zika virus. You know, my guess is there are a few journalists out there who get into this business not knowing exactly what they're going to be doing, but my guess is they're not doing it intending to scare people. I have a bad feeling we're doing it, though, and this time it's in our coverage of the Zika virus. The mosquito-borne illness sickens one in five people who contract it, and symptoms mirror the flu. A strain moving north from Brazil is creating all kinds of panic. Get a taste of it here from ABC's Lindsay Davis.
The real dilemma is for the athletes.
It's very difficult to give advice to people who've devoted the last X number of years training for that. The CDC and the NIH could just give them the facts and the evidence-based information.
The U.S. Olympic Committee is advising athletes to listen to the CDC, while Olympic officials in Rio are trying to downplay the threat. U.S. Soccer's chief medical officer tells us members of the U.S. women's soccer team, who've won three consecutive Olympic gold medals, are taking all necessary precautions in regard to the Zika virus. For 33-year-old U.S. sprinter Dee Dee Trotter, there's no question at all.
I don't care what kind of viruses and stuff come out, we're going to finish this one out.
Because it seems like we have had this conversation before, and we did. It was on October 15th of 2014, only then we were talking about Ebola. Clearly, it doesn't look like we've learned much about how to cover epidemics like this with perspective, and the Zika virus is nothing like Ebola.
Yeah, it's just one of those things where, and I think the Pointer website, I think we have linked to it on our links blog, brings up the fact that when you start talking about children, when you start talking about the fact that it's fast moving or that there are various ways that you can get it, then all of a sudden the media starts running with it. And then you throw in the Olympic element, the fact that the Olympic Games are going to be in Rio. And now all of a sudden you have this ready-made story of hysteria and panic when, in fact, none of that is actually happening. I mean, number one, it's going to be cool during that time, and the threats from mosquito goes down during that time period. And then on top of that, the way in which it's even transmitted, a lot of it is through mosquitoes. But then when the issue came up about the man who contracted it because he had sex with a pregnant woman from being in the zone, then that adds another layer to the story. So, I mean, it's just one of those things where the novelty of it becomes the story, not necessarily the actual virus itself or what can happen when you get the virus.
And some of that, too, Deborah, comes into the imagery that we're choosing and some of that sensationalism.
Right. Again, as Ernest mentioned, you know, the use of children, the use of fetal images, the use of pregnant women. And I think it's important to remember that nobody dies from this virus. And it also gets into ethical and moral questions when you're talking about people not getting pregnant for 2 years, when you're talking about birth control. So I think it's important to put it into perspective, calm down a bit, and make sure that what we're reporting is fact and not just speculation.
Speculation or junk science.
Right.
Junk science.
One of the things that bothers me is that on stories like this, it is an easy way for the media to get attention. I mean, you can get eyeballs watching your show, or you can get clicks onto your website by putting up these headlines, which in essence scare people because they're thinking that, hey, you know, I've got to worry about, you know, mosquitoes outside my home, maybe carrying the Zika virus, when in fact there are other things that mosquitoes here carry, which is far more dangerous.
West Nile virus,
and so many others, you know, that are carried by mosquitoes and other insects right here in our own neighborhoods that can cause much more of a health problem for you than the Zika virus. But we don't talk about those because, you know, they don't bring up those images of children and pregnant women and the things that we've been talking about.
So back in December, we told you about the secret sale of the Las Vegas Review-Journal. That was the newspaper reporters had to literally investigate who it was that was going to be signing their paychecks. And in order to, and now we know that their boss, Sheldon Adelson, it was one of those media stories that the media itself couldn't get enough of. And here we are still watching what's going on there. Well, there have been a couple of noteworthy developments there in the last couple of weeks. Among them, a new editor who is taking over, somebody who's actually coming from the world of journalism scholarship, a fellow at the University of Minnesota School of Journalism and Mass Communication. An interesting choice to leave academia to go back to the newsroom, and that newsroom, too.
Well, I mean, he's had some experience in doing this. J. Keith Moyer, mm-hmm. who previously was at the Minneapolis Star Tribune before he and the Arkansas Gazette before he went to work at the University of Minnesota as a faculty member, and now he's been asked to come in and be an editor of this newspaper. The interesting part that I saw in all of this was the fact that the newspaper itself came out and endorsed Marco Rubio for the upcoming Nevada
primary
yeah. On the Republican mm-hmm. side, and they went to great lengths to say that Adelson had nothing to do with this because they had made this decision before he bought the paper. And of course, their decision is not an endorsement of the family. So, you know, it's kind of interesting how this is playing out. And the other interesting part is that they brought in a new publisher who picked the editor, even though there was supposed to be a committee that was supposed to be picking the editor. So it's kind of a weird situation there right now.
Yeah, and I think there's clearly a segregation of duties from Gatehouse, which the newspaper had contracted with to perform some of these duties, as you said, Ernest, to hire a new editor. And, you know, they've taken down some principles that they used to have on their in the newspaper that indicated their editorial independence. Those came down with the new publisher. Again, this hire, which came about very quickly and bypassed the Gatehouse system that had been in place. So I think there's some really questionable things going on that we have to really watch and pay attention to, and maybe a mini series down the road.
I mean, I think it's going to be interesting to see what happens at this newspaper now that you have these people in place, mm-hmm. because as you remember, when this story first broke, yeah. it was the reporters at the newspaper who did investigative work to determine who bought the newspaper.
Mm-hmm. So who is my boss?
Who is my boss? Yeah. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens to those reporters. I mean, many of them are still there. Is the new editor going to come in and go like, well, you know, guys, we're not going to report on ourselves. And you know, is there going to be any sort of pushback or, you know, revenge for them going out and doing this kind of investigative reporting on their own now mm-hmm. boss and owner? So it's going to be really interesting.
And it's good to keep in mind that newspapers aren't great financial investments.
Right.
Which is what made it so interesting.
Right.
A couple of months ago that Sheldon Adelson went and bought this newspaper to begin with, because especially given his newspaper holdings in Israel and in other parts of the world, this idea that it really is a political device for him as much as anything else, and given his connection as well to the gaming industry in Nevada, right. again, the ability to have that megaphone and that platform and choosing that investment to do that with.
Right.
Well, I mean, it's one of those things where it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out, because it is the largest newspaper in the region, and he is one of the largest property owners mm-hmm. and the gaming industry in that area. So is he going to use that newspaper to try to influence the legislature, both at the local and the state level, to possibly loosen the legal restraints on gaming? I mean, it's going to be really interesting to see how he utilizes that.
Okay, well, the MUKU rivalry, it isn't exactly what it once was now that Mizzou has left the Big 12 and moved to the SEC. That said, I think our student journalists here are grateful not to be in the Jayhawks' shoes right now. The staff of the University Daily Kansan sued the administration, claiming that the Student Senate cut the paper's funding following a critical editorial calling for reform of that body. Does it sound like they have a case here?
I think they do have a case, but it's going to be real interesting because what they did was said, you know, we're cutting funding for a lot of organizations, mm-hmm. and your organization is one that we're going to cut funding to, and you need to reevaluate how you're operating,
mm-hmm.
and if you can prove to us that you need that funding to go back, we will do that. But there's also these sort of comments made by certain members of the Senate that say, well, you know, your content is not up to par and these sorts of things. And
kind of zots or zingers coming back and maybe pointing to some of those.
But to say that it's to say that they're impeding on their First Amendment in today's environment, mm-hmm. I think it's going to be difficult for them to sort of prove that.
I agree. I think that's going to be tough. I read the complaint, and I used to advise a student newspaper for like 7 years, so I do understand those tensions that mm-hmm. go between a student newspaper that's trying to cover its own university campus. In this case, what's different from some of the previous case law is these were students who were making these decisions, although it was upheld by administrators. And administrators certainly had the right to overturn those student funding decisions. I mean, it does sound, on the surface that the students certainly did act in a somewhat retaliatory way toward the newspaper. But again, claiming it's a First Amendment violation, there were no stories taken down. There was no prohibition of any sort of content in that regard. But the argument is that the reduction in funding certainly reduces its ability to produce the kind and quality and quantity of news that it had been doing.
So the Student Press Law Center is involved in this case, helping the KU students and advising them. Tell me a little bit more about this organization, what they do, and how they support student journalists across the country.
Well, certainly, students who are trying to fight these complaints and fighting administrators who have deep pockets and staff lawyers and so forth, the Student Press Law Center is a real champion and has been for decades working to help students fight against prohibitions, against attacks on their freedoms. And they've won awards and they've done really exceptional work throughout the years, and they're a highly respected organization.
Yeah, that's one of the things that makes me think that this may have a chance is that they decided that they would step in and support them, because usually when they do that, they've looked at the case.
They're not going to take a loser, if you will,
Or it may be a situation where they're saying, wait a minute, we need to stand up to this because mm-hmm. the funding part is important in order to be able to produce news and information that's going to be valuable for that audience. So that may be one of the reasons why the Law Center decided to step mm-hmm. in and help out in this situation.
And we don't know how many other cases there have been like this in which there wasn't a lawsuit filed, but I suspect that there have been other cases where money has been withheld from student media operations.
I'm sure there has been. The student newspaper here on our campus, the Maneater, it operates under a different funding model. This really couldn't happen in the same way here.
I don't think it could happen in the same way here, but they do receive some funding from mm-hmm. from MSA. Mm-hmm. So there's always that possibility, but it's also, what is the relationship between that newspaper and student government? What is the relationship between the newspaper and the administration? And that's one of the things I didn't really understand from this story, because it seems like there's a somewhat contentious relationship between the newspaper and the student government, but maybe not so much with the administrators. The administrators may be looking at this as, here's a cost, here's a way for us to deal with a budgetary situation that is really a strain, especially in Kansas with all the funding cuts mm-hmm. at the government level and that sort of thing, and also the push to decrease the student tuition and fees. That may be a factor in this as well.
There's this thing out there that's called shine theory. It's the name given to the act of women supporting other women, the idea that you shine when the ladies around you shine. I guess you could say this is the perfect example. Former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright at a Hillary Clinton rally telling women they should be throwing their support at Clinton over Bernie Sanders.
And a lot of you younger women don't think you have to it's been done. It's not done. And you have to help. Hillary Clinton will always be there for you. And just remember, there's a special place in hell for women who don't help each other.
Okay, well, there's that. Couple that with Gloria Steinem on Bill Maher's talk show on HBO.
And when you're young, you're thinking, you know, where are the boys? The boys are with Bernie, or, you know.
Ooh. Now, if I said that.
No.
Yeah, they're for Bernie, because that's where the boys are.
No,
but
it's
swap
not,
me. Come
no,
on.
No, I wouldn't.
Okay,
I wouldn't, because
good.
Because the boys are saying whether. No, I mean, hello? What do you? How well do you know me? Okay.
Right. Okay. Not that well. I'd love to know you better.
Bill Maher kind of has a point. If he had been the one to say that, she would have gone off on him.
Well, you know, the whole issue, we've talked about this
yeah.
before, is the fact that you have a lot of women
yeah.
Of a certain age, and some would say of the ERA movement back in the 70s and 80s, who are saying, here's our opportunity. Mm-hmm. Here is our opportunity to get a woman in the White House. And this may not happen again for another generation. The only time we've even come this close is Geraldine Ferraro. So,
which now, was back during
which
that
was
period.
Back during that time period. So, and now you see the polls shifting, and even the numbers, especially if you go back and look at what happened in New Hampshire. Bernie Sanders did better with women in New Hampshire than Hillary Clinton. So now you've got this dynamic working, and they're saying, wait a minute, this is our best opportunity, and we're going to lose this because young women don't understand the importance of getting a woman in the White House. And the younger women are saying, we're more concerned about the issues than we are about the person or the gender.
Hillary Clinton actually did do better than Donald Trump, just for the record, too, when you put the numbers next to each other. One of the things that was interesting that Gloria Steinem had also said as in part of that interview is that women have a tendency to think about what's going on for them in the now. So she and the other women of her generation didn't necessarily stop to thank the women before them for the right to vote. They went and fought for equal rights, for equal pay. And that's how she views some of this, is that today's millennial voters are thinking about the issues that affect them today, not necessarily their mothers or their grandmothers and what they fought for. Your thoughts on that, Deborah?
I think it's more complicated than that, frankly. And I'm one of those women, you know, I'm a boomer who grew up in the 70s and 80s. And I have two daughters who are young adults. And there is certainly a feminist movement among young adults. I think what we saw in New Hampshire and what we're seeing in this election overall is really, for the first time, the impact of the millennial generation. And so I think that, you know, when you have people who are in their 80s coming out and endorsing a candidate, that doesn't necessarily speak so well to younger audiences, be they male or female. I mean, I thought Gloria's comment was, you know, ridiculous. But I also realize she's 81. She's on this show where Bill Maher, you know, he makes his money by saying extreme things. So,
well, and she issued an apology and
yes,
characterized
right.
the whole thing as talk show interruptus.
Right.
That it was
right.
a conversation taken during its normal, you know, falling down its normal track. And
right.
that maybe she wasn't able to express exactly what she meant to in the way that came across.
Right. Look, this is a highly contentious and really kind of an unorthodox election that we have going on right now. And people are going to be saying a lot more extreme things as we go along.
Yes, they
and
are.
We're going to be talking about it more in the future. I have no doubt about it.
And I think but part of the issue here, too, because I saw this right after the Madeleine Albright mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. Gloria Steinem's comments. Was you had women, millennial women, and even some women who actually agreed with them, were saying, wait a minute, this is a trust issue. We're not sure whether or not mm-hmm. we can trust Hillary Clinton to do the right thing for us in this time period for the issues that we're concerned about. So that's a
that
part of it,
that may have been
too.
Where Gloria Steinem was going with that whole thing of, like, why my contemporaries didn't think to go and thank the suffragettes for fighting for us to have a right to vote in there. Well, I don't know exactly if this next one that we're going to talk about falls under the category of another feminist issue. I guess it depends on how you look at it. The website The Bustle draws close to 50 million unique visitors a month. Most of them are women. It aggregates news and sometimes riffs on the headlines of the day using personal essays. For example, how Jessica Jones helped me through my own rape. So there's some background. What's going on there that I bring up The Bustle? A new post-employment survey given to new employees. Some of the questions up top: what is your sexual orientation, your religion, your political affiliation, marital status, whether you have children or not? All questions that would be against the law to ask during the job interview or during that screening process. And then there's question number 32, which asks employees to check all that apply. Under that category, literally dozens of options, ranging from I'm from a large family to I'm the mom of my friend group. Then there's I've had an abortion, I've smoked weed, I've been to jail or prison, and the list goes on and on. Deborah, let me start by asking you, your initial reaction to hearing some of those questions on that survey?
Well, of course, if you were to ask them as part of an employment process, no, it'd be illegal.
Yeah.
Right, it'd be illegal. I thought they were rather extreme, but at the same time, it seemed as though the media outlet was saying they were optional.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't required. And I do recall being in newsrooms where, you know, if the features department is trying to find somebody who's adopted, you know, children from another country, for instance, you get a note around through the internet, you know, among newsroom employees trying to find these kinds of things. I think there are certainly different notions of privacy and different notions of confessional sorts of journalism among millennials, for instance. You know, I think what would certainly be unfortunate is if somebody who really relied on this revenue felt as though it was a requirement. And then, of course, there's the whole validity issue. I mean, who's to say anybody's responding in an accurate way to this information? And security. I mean, to me, that's the biggest concern. How do we know that they're keeping this very private, detailed information in any kind of secure way where it, you know, where somebody could hack in and get it and, you know, really ruin people's personal lives in a very devastating way?
Yeah, that was a concern that I had because, you know, when you actually look at the survey, you're going like, wait a minute, you know, if somebody fills this out, what's to keep this information private? And to send it out in that way, to me, it would be more beneficial for editors who want to have that information to have maybe individual or maybe
on a case by case
on a case by case basis, or to maybe talk to small groups to try to figure out, okay, is there someone who may have some expertise in this area that can be helpful? And the other problem I have is, why are we worried about the stories? Or I don't say worried is not the right word, but why are we so concerned about what our employees have experienced in this sort of thing when the story should be about what others have experienced so that you can relay that to a larger audience?
Then maybe that's part of and Ernest, I keep hearing you say over and over and over again to me, to our students, it's not about you.
Yeah.
Well,
right.
Maybe that's one of the issues that comes up with some of these news aggregator sites that are out there like The Bustle, is that they aren't out there talking to the people in the communities that they're serving. It's about them.
Right, right.
And they're making the news about them.
Right. It's almost like this is what we're interested in and we think you need to be interested too. And maybe that's good for clickbait, but if you're trying to do that, but then also trying to do serious stories, you're sort of confusing, or you have the potential to confuse your audience, and then they're going to go somewhere else. So, and go back to the survey, you're still talking about privacy, and you open yourself up to some legal issues here if that private information gets out to someone who can use it for whatever reason. So, you know, that would be my biggest concern, one of my biggest concerns there.
Well, and I went to the site. I didn't find it particularly interesting, and I didn't even consider it really news per se. I mean, I saw it more like a series of very personal gossip columns almost, you know, packed in there, but certainly it's having huge audiences. Mm-hmm. So somebody resonates with this kind of stuff. Nonetheless, there are lots of different ways, better ways that they could seek to find potential sources and writers for that kind of content.
Okay. Well, before we go.
Hello, we are not available now. Please leave your name and phone number after the beep. We will return your call.
Maybe it's a millennial thing or just a sign of how prolific texting has become. We're not leaving voicemail messages the way we once were. Someone doesn't answer the phone, we hang up and we shoot over a text message. That's why I was so surprised to hear that CNN and the Washington Post are looking at new ways to incorporate voice messaging into their storytelling. The idea here is that they're going to use voicemail as a new means of collecting user-generated content, that there's going to be a prompt that they're going to issue to the audience. Give out a phone number, give us a call, tell us your story.
You know, I looked at this and the first thing I thought about was, if I receive this, probably the first thing I would do is hang up. if it's not a number that I recognize, mm-hmm. or if it's not a text that I recognize, I don't pay attention to it. I ignore it. So it's sort of like you've got to figure out a way to engage the audience and to try to go about it in this fashion can turn them off, because it's one more distraction or one more thing that I don't need to be paying attention to.
Look, fail fast and fail often. I predict this is going to fail.
and I guess give them credit for trying something. But yeah, and if it does fail, I mean, one of the ideas here is if I give you a number as a journalist and say, call me and leave me a message with your story. Right. Okay, maybe I feel like I'm just kind of putting it out there. I can also see then how there are issues with verification or making sure that, you know, you go back and you talk to the person. And is it an implied consent that if I call you and leave you a message that you then have the right to air that? And am I then going to hear myself on CNN simply because I pick up the phone and leave that message? Right. It just seems like, while an interesting idea, perhaps, and we don't know about backroom discussions, but it seems like there are a lot of ways where maybe it wasn't.
I was also wondering, did they test this out? How did this come about? Was this an idea that just, you know, came out of someone's head and say, hey, let's try this, which is fine, but I think you might want to test it out before you go public with it.
And it might be a way to try to diversify sources, sure, and user-generated content. It might be a way to try to get older individuals to respond or people who don't have access to computers or other kinds of things. Who knows?
Okay. Well, that music means we're pretty much out of time for this week. I'd like to thank you for spending the last half hour with us. You can read more about the topics we talked about today. Check out our links blog under the programs tab at kbia.org. You can like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle there is @viewsonkbia. These are all great ways to watch and listen to our program again, leave us comments, questions, see some previews of what we'll be talking about next week, and more. Our thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan for directing today's show. Maya Jackson is our technical director. Pat Akers handled the audio for us, and C. Chen is our associate producer. I'm Amy Simons. Be sure to join us again next week when we're back with you for another edition of Views of the News.